What happened on the first week of COP27, the biggest climate conference taking place in Egypt right now? Welcome to the Climate Recap from the Beckosphere Climate Corner, your go-to place for international and U.S.-based climate news. I'm Becky Hoag, a climate communicator. Sorry this one is so late. If you saw the COP video on YouTube, then this is going to be the same content. But if not, stick with me and let's jump right into the news. So now we are through the first week of COP27. For those of you who don't know, COP stands for Conference of the Parties. This is the 27th one organized to talk about the climate crisis and the first one to be located in arguably the most impacted continent, Africa. African countries represent less than 4% of global emissions, but will likely see some of their populated spaces become uninhabitable due to climate change in the next like 50 years or so. The top of mind this year for the climate conference, therefore, is getting wealthy countries to pay for loss and damage funds to help developing countries with the climate worsening events. Developing and emerging economies will need $2 trillion a year by 2030 to handle extreme weather events. It wouldn't be this expensive if we wealthy nations had supported other countries sooner. They've been asking for this for like 30 years. Egypt, who is the host of this year's event, announced that the topic will finally officially be on the conference schedule. Wealthy countries are clearly not great at paying for things because they also haven't started providing the $100 billion a year to developing nations to help them transition to clean energy like they promised all the way back in 2009 to begin in 2020. So they had a lot of time to prep. And now they're being asked to step up with the loss and damage funding. Paying for losses and damages is the right thing to do because these countries, again, did not really benefit as much from the Industrial Revolution, which started the whole fossil fuel problem. They're experiencing the consequences of decisions that they had no control over. Additionally, most of the money that developing nations can access right now to help with these loss and damage money comes in the form of loans from the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank. Now, world leaders agreed to reform the World Bank to make it more useful for developing countries to access finances, but it looks like that they're still going to continue to do the loan thing, which doesn't really solve the root of the problem, which is that developing countries have been in debt to the IMF and the World Bank for a long time. In fact, the amount of money these countries owe extensively dwarfs the amount of money that they have received in support. And so they're too busy paying off these loans to be able to invest in infrastructure and climate adaptation strategies. So it's just like a vicious cycle. One idea to get them out of this cycle is to create a program that allows for a debt to nature swap, where debt is forgiven if the money that would have gone to that payment instead goes to climate adaptation and conservation methods. This idea has been supported by many developing nations, but so far we're not seeing any support by wealthy nations for that. Instead, Germany plans to announce its Global Shield initiative, which is meant to fix flaws in the humanitarian systems, but critics say that it's just another way for wealthy countries to keep the developing ones burdened through insurance premiums. So this year's climate conference, again, takes place in Africa, takes place in Egypt, specifically Sharm el-Sheikh. And this is the first time that a COP has been hosted by an African country. And we are seeing African voices being heard more due to this. And again, Egypt's government formally putting the discussion of loss and damages on the agenda for the first time in COP history. So that's good that the location will help emphasize African voices, but I'm not really sure Egypt was the best African country to support this effort. Egypt is a heavy fossil fuel user itself, and it also has been known for its human rights abuses. Ahead of the event, we saw Egypt squash activism and protest efforts and cancel event spaces on the first Monday of the conference. And these kind of pavilions are usually spaces where NGOs, climate activists, scientists, celebrities, and politicians alike can exchange ideas outside of formal talks. Egypt made it clear to its activists, scientists, and academics that it doesn't want people to talk about corporate interests like tourism, agribusiness, and real estate, military businesses like water bottling plants, cement factories and quarry mines, and industrial pollution. And those that did speak out, or those that are in general protesting the government, dozens of them have been already imprisoned. In the end, Egypt did open a space where activists could protest, but it was located way away from the actual venue, so that's purposely not helpful. So already COP27 has been disadvantaged due to its host, and then companies active at the conference weren't ideal either. One of the most well-known things about this conference this year is that it's sponsored by Coca-Cola, which has continuously been ranked one of the top plastic polluters in the world. By allowing the company to sponsor this large climate event, COP27's leadership is helping Coca-Cola greenwash itself. As a reminder, plastic is mainly made of fossil fuels, so the plastic industry is a way for oil and gas industries to stick around into the future, even if our energy sector goes green. So that's one of the reasons why this is incredibly hypocritical. The COP27 Farming Coalition is also under fire for working with the North American Meat Institute, or NAMI, which has openly questioned the origins of climate change on its website. The Agriculture Innovation Mission for Climate, or AIM4C, was started by the U.S. and the United Arab Emirates during COP26 last year to fund research into agriculture-based technologies meant to reduce the sector's climate impact. NAMI, which represents the largest meat companies in the U.S., was named a knowledge partner despite questioning climate science. AIM4C has also been accused of promoting industry-favored techno-fixes over meaningful sector reform ahead of COP27. So, that's fun. And on top of all that, the American PR firm Hill & Knowlton have been working with Egypt to organize it. Hill & Knowlton has helped the 12 members of the Oil and Gas Climate Initiative, which includes ExxonMobil, Shell, Chevron, and Saudi Aramco, to greenwash themselves and disseminate climate misinformation over the decades. In September, UN Secretary General Guterres called out the PR giant for raking in billions to shield the fossil fuel industry from scrutiny. Quote, just as they did for the tobacco industry decades before, lobbyists and spin doctors have spewed harmful misinformation. Fossil fuel interests need to spend less time averting PR disasters and more time averting a planetary one. Hill and Knowlton has also helped Coca-Cola greenwash itself, so we are having a full circle moment. So the combination of activists being silenced and polluting corporations supporting the conference has resulted in famous activist Greta Thunberg opting to boycott the conference this year, calling it a scam. And then the countries attending did not prepare well for the conference, which was less advertised than COP26. All 193 countries were required to update their national determined contributions, preferably to more ambitious goals. NDCs are basically decarbonization pledges. But by the time that the deadline passed, only 19 countries actually follow through with this. And the only country that really had an impact on its NDC update was Australia, which reflects the recent change in leadership. The country has pledged to reduce emissions by 43% by 2030. This target still lags behind its peers in North America and Europe, but it's a positive change for the 15th historically largest emitter. Despite Australia being a bright spot in that previous bullet point, though, Prime Minister Albanese chose not to attend COP27. He was not alone in this decision by far. More than 100 world leaders, including those for China, India, Russia, Canada, Argentina, Brazil, Japan, South Korea, Mexico, Turkey, and Indonesia, opted out of this year's conference, downgrading its importance. President Biden didn't come until Friday because of the midterms. That means only two of the top 10 historic emitters saw their leaders attend the first week of the conference, the two being Germany and the UK. European leaders did a bit better with attending this event in general. Meanwhile, 33 African leaders attended the conference. Out of the 110 world leaders that did attend the conference, only 7 of them were women, which definitely shows a questionable representation. The number of delegates attending COP27 that has ties to the fossil fuel industry also jumped by 25% compared to last year's conference, according to Global Witness. It pointed to 636 people with ties to the fossil fuel industry out of about 35,000 people, so thankfully, it's still relatively low, but that still sucks. And the problem, especially, is that the expected host of COP28, which is the United Arab Emirates, has the vast majority of that spike. Russia is in second place, and many others actually represent African nations. There are more delegates representing fossil fuels than there are representing the top 10 climate change impacted countries, which is gross. Additionally, Egypt told other top oil countries ahead of the conference that it would support gas as a
transition fuel.
Many financial giants like BlackRock, Citigroup, and Standard Chartered also opted not to come this year. Last month, Bloomberg NEF gave COP27 only a 43% chance of succeeding at anything big. So, lovely. That's the backdrop that we see this year's conference in. It's a shit show. Despite this being the case, it's still important to pay attention to these conferences because things might happen that could potentially put us on a better trajectory. Emphasis on might, because the two biggest pledges that came out of last year, which was to reduce deforestation and reduce methane emissions, have made no progress this year. In fact, deforestation and methane emissions both spiked this year, so but let's hope that the loss and damage funding doesn't experience the same fate. We're still going to get into it. Don't click out, okay? Let's still see what they ended up doing so far this week, okay? We gotta hold them accountable, right? So here are the top 7 things to happen so far out of COP27. Obviously, I might have missed something because there's a lot going on, so if I do, please inform the community down in the comment section below. Before we look at the takeaways for COP27, I just wanted to give a little shout out to all the other platforms that I am on. So if you are interested, definitely check me out on my Instagram account. I have a personal Instagram, which is the Beckosphere, and then I also have one specifically for climate news called the Climate Recap. And then I also post climate news on TikTok as well at Beckosphere. So check out both of those. And if you want to see me more candidly, I do Twitch streams twice a week on Tuesday and Friday from 10 to 12 Pacific Standard Time. So definitely check me out there. On Tuesdays, we go over climate news, and on Fridays, we talk about a particular topic. The last topic that we talked about is eco-fascism and eco-authoritarianism. So we kind of go all over the place. Next Friday, we're going to talk about different types of batteries. So look forward to that. And then if you are unable to make those, I do have another channel called Beckosphere Streams where I post the Friday episodes on there. So you can see the eco-fascism one there. And again, if you would like to support the work I do, because this is what I do, then definitely check me out on Patreon and buy me a cup of coffee for recurring and one-time payments. All right, back to your regularly scheduled program. Number one, African countries show division over fossil fuels. Tanzania will sign a key agreement with energy companies, including Equinor ASA and Shell LPC, next month to pave the way for a $40 billion liquefied natural gas project. They claim that they will do everything they can to reduce the project's greenhouse gas emissions. Okay. Meanwhile, the activist and director of the climate think tank PowerShift Africa, Mohamed Addo, accused the EU, particularly Germany, of using Africa like a gas station to get off of Russian fossil fuels. He argues this effort is short-sighted and locks Africa into long-term fossil fuel use. Quote, "Our continent is at a crossroads. The message we want to send to Scholz as he comes here is that the days of colonialism are over. We won't accept energy colonialism." The topic of energy colonialism, which has been brought up in both fossil fuels and clean energy, is a discussion for a whole different video, and particularly when it comes to talking about Africa's relationship with fossil fuels. But the basic juxtaposition is that it would be better for African people, financially and health-wise, to skip the fossil fuel step and go straight to clean energy, but they currently don't have enough financial support to get there, and fossil fuels is an opportunity to make money in the short term. Meanwhile, wealthy countries in Europe and North America in particular are telling African countries to transition faster to clean energy while simultaneously wanting them to export more of their fossil fuels over to Europe. And Europe is also increasing its fossil fuel use, production, and exploration while telling African countries to decarbonize. So hypocrisy, hypocrisy, hypocrisy. The hypocrisy could go much deeper if we look at how the history of colonialism impacts countries' abilities to industrialize, maintain a stable government structure to deal with big issues like climate change, and moderate regional environmental conditions. But again, that's a whole other video. But bottom line, Africa being conflicted on whether or not to continue with fossil fuel use or to move to clean energy and how that would happen is point one of this year's conference. And you can see the conflictingness between the announcement of the new LNG project in Tanzania and also what the think tank guy is saying about fossil fuel use and colonialism. Point number two, the host of COP28, the United Arab Emirates, touted its fossil fuels as more responsibly sourced energy because it has a lower carbon intensity than other options. Carbon intensity can vary based on how much emissions it takes to extract, produce, and transport the fossil fuels. So it is actually true that the UAE's fossil fuel is less carbon intensive than if it was coming out of California or Canada. Yeah, they are very carbon intense. But fossil fuels are still a main carbon emitter, so I'm not exactly sure why you are touting that information. And touting it as responsibly sourced energy suggests that they're frankly still not really taking the climate crisis seriously, so that increases my concern of them being COP28's host. Point three, the Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia said his country's sovereign wealth fund will target net zero emissions by 2050. Saudi Arabia is the world's top oil producer, so this could be a big deal if they stick to this promise and don't fully rely on carbon capture and offsets. The prince said that they're looking to diversify their energy sources. Four, wealthy countries cough up some money to help developing countries adapt to climate change and pay for losses and damages. At COP26, only Scotland had promised to provide money for losses and damages at $2.2 million. Right before COP27, Scotland's minister upped that amount to $5.7 million. Denmark said before the conference that it would spend $13 million on this effort as well. And then during the conference, Ireland pledged $10 million towards the effort, Austria pledged $50 million, Belgium Belgium pledged $2.5 million, and for Belgium, that was specifically for Mozambique, which is interesting. German Chancellor Scholz pledged $170 million towards the country's global shield effort after it was announced, and the UK's new PM Sunak announced that the nation will triple its funding towards adaptation projects to $1.7 billion by 2025, which is not losses and damages, but it's proactive, so that's good. Despite initially saying that the US would support loss and damage discussions, when it came down to actually following through, the US was noticeably absent for these conversations and pledges. 5. The US's climate envoy John Kerry announced the US's carbon credit scheme, where companies can purchase carbon offsets, where the money will go towards helping developing countries move towards clean energy and adapt to climate change. This idea was immediately met with skepticism by the UN Secretary General, European leaders, economists, and climate activists alike. Carbon offsets have been questioned for many years because it's practically impossible to ensure the money from the offsets will actually reduce the emissions that they represent. Oftentimes, these offsets cost much less than they actually should to properly represent the emissions that they're offsetting. Some of the environmental organizations at the US State Department briefed on this plan, like the National Resource Defense Council and the World Resources Institute, don't actually approve of the plan. They say that it could actually undermine efforts to globally decarbonize. So yeah, no one liked that move, US. No one liked it. 6. The US proposed a rule to push all major federal contractors to line up their decarbonization efforts with Paris climate goals. So that's to keep warming at or below 1.5 degrees Celsius above pre-industrial levels. We're currently at 1.1, and there's almost no pathway to get to 1.5 at this point, but we should still aim for it. The US is the largest buyer of goods and services, purchasing more than $630 billion just this last fiscal year. So this could be a very big deal coming from the US if the proposal gets backed up and followed through on, but I'm not really sure how it is going to get followed through on, so maybe we'll learn more about that starting next week. 7. 17 environmental and finance experts worked with the former Canadian Environment and Climate Minister McKenna to produce a 10-point recommendation for non-state actors to effectively decarbonize without greenwashing themselves. The group called for companies to shift from voluntary net zero initiatives to regulated processes under a national scale. They also recommended inserting emissions data in a UN portal for better transparency. And here are some other recommendations meant to counteract greenwashing. Include scope 3 emissions, which are emissions that are indirect from supply chain and product end use. Publicly spell out transition plans that show both near-term emissions cuts and spending plans that are consistent with meeting their targets. Disclose information that can be compared to competitors' data. Companies should not claim to be on their way to net zero while continuing to build or invest in new fossil fuel infrastructure, deforestation, or other environmentally damaging activities. Companies should not lobby against government climate policies either on their own or through trade associations. And companies should also not buy cheap emissions credits before cutting their own emissions. Ironically, that last one directly goes against the US's carbon offsetting scheme. So these recommendations aren't binding in any way, so it'll be interesting to see if any leaders actually take their proposals seriously. I almost missed this one, but it's like actually one of the most important things to come out of the conference so far, so let's talk about it. 8. UN officials unveiled a detailed roadmap and cost estimates to make early warning systems accessible for everyone. Some of the most vulnerable places to extreme weather events have no or inadequate early warning systems. Only half of the world's nations have access to an early warning system, and that's a big deal because countries without an adequate early warning system experience a disaster mortality rate 8 times higher than those with good systems. The officials are working with tech companies like Microsoft, financial agencies, etc. on this effort. The 4 pillars they want to tackle are data collection and risk management, development of hazard monitoring and early warning services, building national and local response capabilities, and communication of understandable information. Early warning systems and organized responses are essential climate adaptation measures as wildfires, floods, hurricanes, and droughts get worse and continue to become more common. So this was an important development to come out of this conference. And those were the 7 things that came out of COP27 so far. I know a lot of them are not actually anything, but they could be something. I think it is also important to remember that while these conferences are usually a letdown, we have slowly moved the needle from expecting about 5 degrees warming above pre-industrial levels to now 2.5 degrees Celsius. 2.5 degrees Celsius is still catastrophic climate change, but progress has been made despite it really not feeling like any progress has been made year by year. So we're not talking as much about needing massive geoengineering schemes like we used to, and that's a good thing. And that was your climate recap for COP27, week one. If you like the work I do, please follow this podcast, give it a 5-star rating, leave a review, and consider checking out the Beckosphere Climate Corner YouTube channel. Remember to talk about the climate crisis every single day and to support your local news organizations. Bye for now.